Hi, this is Dr. David Stevens, your host of Christian Doctors Digest. You know what? I just about wasn't with you today to do this recording. I'm getting ready to leave first thing in the morning with the assessment team that's going into the Philippines with our first global health relief team. Why do I mention that? Because I want you to pray. I mean, we need your prayers. That's the most important thing. As we leave it, things are uncertain about what we're going to be doing, where we're going to be working. But your prayers already are making a difference and will make a difference as you are reminded again to do that. But I didn't want to get away before getting this ready to go out the door because we have such a great lineup of interviews. We're going to start with Walt Larimore. And everybody loves Walt, and he always has great things to say. We're going to be talking about his new book. You're going to find some great information there to provide to your patients as well as perhaps to your teenagers if you've got some. Then we're going to move over to talking about evangelism with Downline Ministries, a great group out of Memphis that's been working with us in global health outreach. And then finish up with a wonderful story from Dave Hafer, one of my good friends, who has headed our efforts on physician-assisted suicide in Montana, trying to defeat the initiatives there. And in the midst of that, went through cancer. And what a miraculous story he's going to share. Well, I'm in a rush to get out the door, and I know you're busy too. Let's get to that first interview. It's always great to have Walt Larimore on Christian Doctors Digest. You know, we helped launch Walt's writing career. Actually, we asked him to write his first book as part of our Medically Reliable, Biblically Sound series that we did. And that just launched him into writing, and it's been a blessing to so many people. Walt got his MD degree from LSU, graduated with AOA honors, and did a family medicine residency, practiced up in the mountains of North Carolina before going to Florida, and then, of course, was involved at Focus on the Family as their vice president and physician in residence. Now is very busy writing, speaking, and still practicing medicine. So let's hear what Walt has to say about his latest book called The Ultimate Guy's Body Book. I think you're going to get some great insights. Walt, catch us up on your life. I know a lot of people know you or know of you, and you keep writing books. What else is going on?
Well, Dave, it's an exciting season, and isn't that true for all of us who walk with the Lord? I don't say that frivolously. Each day has new mercies. Each day has new difficulties. Each day has new fruit. But hope continues, and I revel in that.
Two new books out, one about a year ago and one just being released, both of them related. Tell us about the girl's body book and the guy's body book.
Or as the publisher has hyperbolically named them, the ultimate girl's body book and the ultimate boy's body book. Boy, marketers are something, Dave.
Yeah, you don't bother to write another one, anyone, because this is it.
But starting back in Bryson City, North Carolina, when I first went in practice back in the 80s, one of the things I really enjoyed doing was going into the public school system and talking to fifth graders about their changing bodies. And I did that through the 4 years in Bryson City and 16 years down in Kissimmee, Florida, and then now up here in Colorado Springs, to talk to fifth graders in a classroom setting, often with their parents there, allowing them to ask any question that they want, Dave. And as you can imagine, they've come up with some very interesting questions. And I just cataloged those through the years. And then a few years back, just felt the Spirit beginning to move to say, you know, there may not be a time in history where it's more important for dads and moms to come alongside their children that are heading into and through puberty. There's so many competing resources for their interest and for their money and for their affections. It's time for mom and dad to come up to bat, if you would, or come back to bat like they used to in the old days. And so these books, Dave, are designed to help parents come alongside their children and to be trusted advisors to them with some of the scariest questions that they've ever asked.
Well, I when I read through the book, I thought, wow, I've just read the guy's body book. I wish I'd had this when Jason was 9 to 12, which is the target age of it, because it just makes it so natural to sit down and go through this together and deal with difficult topics to bring up in any other way. And it's humorous and it's short. Each chapter's short and yet comprehensive. And you made it biblically based, medically reliable. Tell us about the review. I mean, I was amazed how many people you had review this book, including kids that were going to be reading it.
Well, Dave, much thanks to CMDA, because the over 60 advisors for each book, mostly men for the boys' book, mostly women for the girls' book, included CMDA professionals of every stripe, but also included theologians, pastors, youth education specialists, psychiatrists, psychologists, coaches, and then in the case of the boys' books, father-son pairs like our own Scott Rees and his son were one of those pairs, and then for the girls' book, mother-daughter pair, because I really wanted a book that was, as you said, biblically sound and medically reliable. And Dave, the input from the kids was just spectacular. There are multiple chapters in each book where I give quotes from the kids. As one example, we talk about tattooing and tanning and that sort of stuff, skin care. But in the tattooing chapter, I was really wrestling with how do you express to kids the significant dangers of tattooing medically and the emotional dangers, particularly the regret. The majority of kids that get tattoos end up regretting them. And as you know, they're very difficult and very expensive to remove. And one of our little teen reviewers said, this is the advice that I would give to teens. Tell, in this case, little boys, that their body's not their own. A, the Lord owns their body. And B, their body is for their future wife. And why would you want to mark it up with something that she might not approve of? And I thought, what a wonderful piece of advice. So they are short. They are concise. I think they are practical. And they're designed, in the case of the boys' book, to get dad and his son talking, and in particular to communicate to the son that you can ask me anything you want. I want to be a source of information. I may not know all the answers, but we can certainly find out the answers to the questions. In the case of the girls' book, to put mom together with her daughter.
And what about those single moms and single dads that are out there? How do you advise them to do this?
Oh, it's a huge issue. Or what about the mom or dad who's what I call the marshmallow or sloth parent who just doesn't care, the kid who may pick up this book and want answers but not have a parent who's willing to come alongside them. And so the first two chapters of each book, one is a note to the girl or to the boy about how to approach the book, and one is a note to the parent. In the case of the single mom or the single dad, we encourage them to embrace the fact that in the case of a single dad, he cannot be mom. Mm-hmm. He wasn't designed female. God designed male and female. He created them. And so in his case, he needs to have trusted Christian women in his daughter's life. Maybe one, it may be more. Maybe a grandmother, it may be an aunt, maybe a pastor's wife or a youth pastor's wife or a coach's wife or a Sunday school leader, Bible study or community Bible study leader, but a woman that he can link his daughter up. In the case of the single mom, and Dave, there's no harder job in the world, I think, than being a single parent. But hooking her young man up with some trusted Christian men, a man or men, who can help guide her son through this. And there'll be cases where a mom will be comfortable going through this with her son, or a dad comfortable going through it with his daughter. But in general, this seems to be one area where the same-sex advice really can deeply, deeply penetrate and affect for a lifetime.
You know, Walt, you didn't shy away from the tough questions, too, and I like the way that you kind of started out with the ones that aren't so embarrassing for kids to talk about, you know, what's happening to my body and why I don't have big muscles and things like that, and then get into, you know, once the communication lines are in place, beginning to get the more difficult ones. But run through some of the topics you covered. It's very complete.
Well, it's not only physical health, but because physical health is related to emotional, relational, and spiritual health, I try to use all of those four health wheels as we go through the book, and particularly in the girls' book, addressing emotions in adolescence. Dave, you and I both have had teen girls in our
life. What
happened?
One day they're not your little girl anymore.
No, I mean, one day that sweet little girl, and the next day it's an emotional tsunami, if you would. But for example, the girls' book, we address, you know, the physical questions of first period and breasts and when will I develop and what if I'm behind and what if I'm ahead, but also what about makeup and growth spurts and acne and tattooing and piercing and the tsunami of childhood obesity. What do I do if I'm overweight? Should I go on a diet? And what if my friends had periods before me? And what about hair under my arms and hair on my legs? And can my moods be dangerous? What about eating disorders? And what about depression? And what makes me sweat? And what gives me BO? And what gives me bad breath? But even critical issues for little girls about purity and modesty, and for little boys about becoming reliable and responsible men. Because, Dave, in Scripture, God addresses young men and young women very early as being very, very important. You look at the example of the young boys that are lifted up in Scripture, whether it's Isaac or Moses or David and Jonathan and Jeremiah and Samson and Daniel and Isaiah and Timothy. If you look at the disciples, it appears that with the exception of Peter, they were all very young teens. When Christ began his Christian movement on earth, it was a youth movement that he began. And if we look at girls and we look at young Mary, a young teen who God chose to put his son in, the creator of life, into a young teen woman, whether we look at Esther or dozens of female examples, I wanted to be able to communicate to young teens, even prepubescent teens, that God considers you a man of God and a woman of God at a very early age. One of the reasons our Jewish friends celebrate the movement into adulthood when the young kids are 13. They get their bat mitzvah, their bar mitzvah. And Dave, in evangelical Christianity, we're seeing more and more churches have celebration of young men becoming responsible, young women becoming responsible. So I want parents to come alongside their kids at a very early age, because during those pubescent years, there's going to be some very ugly characters coming after them, specifically targeting them in their neighborhoods, in their schools, and through electronic media.
Yeah. And you, I think so wisely deal with the issues before they become the big issues so that they're really prepped. You know, from alcohol to pornography to masturbation for boys, all these issues are addressed in a very sensitive, very biblical way, very scriptural way, scripture in every chapter. So what weren't you able to put in the book that people need to know?
You know, Dave, I think I was most saddened by the fact that I wrote a chapter for each book of a question that kids ask at this age, and it's, am I gay? Little boys are attracted to little boys. That's their best friends. I remember I didn't have a girlfriend until like the 10th grade. You know, my best friend were my guys, you know, the kids I played ball with and the scouts I went out with. And kids these days are beginning to ask, does that mean I'm gay? Because there are societal forces saying, hey, if you like little boys and don't like little girls, you're gay. You must have been born that way. And so I wanted to address those questions. I felt they were absolutely critical. And as an appendix to each book, I attached the CMDA statement on Homosexuality Day, which I think is one of the best evidence-based research statements out on the risks of homosexuality. But in both cases, the boys' book and the girls' book, the publisher decided not to publish those chapters, not to make them available. And it was a real crisis for me because, well, do I pull the whole book? Because I feel it's very important to give kids information about the questions they're asking and information that's biblically sound and medically reliable. But I decided after much prayer, talking with Barb, talking with my pastor, talking with my spiritual mentor of the last 30 years, that the books were so important to get published that I would publish them without that information. And I've been really blessed that a number of ministries have taken the chapters, Am I Gay?, and actually post it on their website so the parents who want that information can print it off and have it available.
Walt, you've given us an invaluable tool, not only for our own families and our grandchildren. In fact, after I finished reading the guy's body book, I thought, I'm taking it this weekend to my daughter and son-in-law for Josiah. Now, Josiah is almost two, but this is the ultimate book, so it's going to be good for a long time. And so they'll have this in their library as they begin looking for it. So I just want to thank you for the extremely thorough, extremely biblical, extremely sensitive and complete book that you have written to put a tool into our hands and a something for us to recommend to our patients and their families. I mean, this needs to be something that we propagate. What a great way to share the gospel and raise those issues for providing a very practical book that has a scriptural basis that's going to help them raise their kids.
Dave, thanks to CMDA for providing so many experts to participate in the process. And I can imagine every one of our members, male, female, all of the doctors that are listening, to have the ability to pass this book on to fathers and mothers that they know and love, Sunday school groups, small groups, and maybe even consider, pray about once a year, having the fifth graders in your church get together, the boys in one class, the girls in another class, and begin to address these factors. You could be a psychiatrist, a plastic surgeon, in any specialty, but the fact that you're a doctor, that you're a physician, a dentist, an oral surgeon, it doesn't matter. The pedestal upon which God has placed each of us into the professions he has called us allows us to speak, Dave, not only into society, as you demonstrate so clearly there in your role at CMDA, but in each of our neighborhoods and each of our churches. So my real prayer for these books is that they are tools that allow us to begin to help protect our children's innocence and help draw them, call them, into biblical responsibility. Can you imagine that happening not only across the country, but across the world?
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much.
It's been a blessing, Dave.
Wow, Walt's given you some great ideas on how to use this resource in your own area. I know you're busy, but investing in the lives of young people is something that will bear fruits forever. I still remember the doc who did the education for young teenage boys at our local church and affected my son. And what a blessing it was that he invested that time. If you'd like to get a copy of the book and check it out, it's available at CMDA, 888-230-2637. Or you go to cmda.org and order online. If you're going to do something at church, I bet you they give you a discount to get a bunch of them for all the boys and parents involved. Just check it out, see what God wants you to do, and you'll touch lives. We've been partnering with Keenan Vaughn and Downline Ministries, sending some of his staff on our GHO trips to do church education and also train our GHO participants. Keenan is the founder and director of Downline Ministries, and they encourage a restoration of biblical discipleship, essentially a multiplication principle just like Christ did. They give some wonderful tools to do that. Keenan is a dynamic communicator and motivator, and so it's just a real joy to have him here with us. I think you're going to find some very helpful insights that'll not only inspire you, but help you to inspire others. Keenan, let's talk about discipleship. That's what Downline Ministries is all about. You've committed your life to it. Let's kind of start with your motivation, and then we want to get very much into the how-tos, because I think each one of us know we should be doing discipleship, but often people don't. So how did you get into this?
Yeah, you know, really, I always say the Lord was very gracious. I did not really learn discipleship through a Bible study on it or really just anything cognitive as much as it was experiential. I had the great privilege of connecting with a man named Soup Campbell. He lives in the inner city in Memphis, and I'd heard him speak one night and just was so drawn to the Lord in him. This guy resonates the gospel and can absolutely teach the word, and I just went up to him afterwards and just knew he had something I desperately wanted in terms of his relationship with Christ and love for the word, and so I just began to kind of ask him about that, and through our conversation he ultimately invited me to come to his house, which was in an area of Memphis I was not very familiar with. We were kind of from different sides of the track, so to say, and so I went at 5 one morning into probably the darkest most dangerous neighborhood in Memphis at the time, and met with Soup on his front porch, and he said a sentence to me that really changed my life. He said, "I don't care how smart you are, and I don't care how talented you are. All I care about is whether or not you can be faithful. And if you can, I'll show you how to be a man of God." And he said those words, and I had been a professing Christian for 10 years with very little spiritual growth, direction, and didn't know how to find it. And when he said that, I just came apart on his front porch, and it was as if I had always wanted someone to ask me that question or give me that invitation and not even known it until he did. And so I said, "I don't even know what you mean, but I want what you're offering." And the next 3 years, he just did what he said. He didn't just teach me. We did study the Word every Tuesday morning at his house. But he let me walk with him, and he showed me what it means to live and talk and share and lead as a godly man. And boy, I experienced transformation through that relationship like I had never had before. And it was because I was experiencing really a Christ model, Christ-centric discipleship model.
So how do we disciple? You know, we hear about mentoring, we hear about coaching, we hear all these other words, but the Bible obviously defines it very clearly.
Yeah.
Talk about that definition, and then talk about how you all go about that process through Downline Ministries and how individuals could apply those principles in their own relationships.
Yeah, well, that's a great question and a very big question, and I think the definition is vital. I used to have a professor in seminary, Howard Hendricks, he used to say that if you're aiming at the wrong target, then even if you hit the bullseye, you still missed. And I think it's a relevant point in this conversation. I've interviewed thousands of people across the country on what does it mean to make disciples, and I've gotten 1,000 different answers. And it's just showed me that somehow something that must be clear in the church has become very foggy. And there are other buzzwords, like you said, coaching, mentoring, and which are great things and have principles of discipleship richly laden within them. But I think Jesus meant something, and I think the best way to figure out what he meant in the Great Commission that we're referring to in Matthew 28, when he said, "Go and make disciples of all nations," I think the best chance we have to understand is to look at his life as the model. Because there was no Q&A after the Great Commission. These disciples seemed to understand what Jesus meant. They seem to not be foggy as we are today, and their lives bear out the testimony of what they thought that to be. And so if we look at Christ's relationship with them as a blueprint, I think we'll get pretty close. And we see that, you know, from the time he met them, it was an invitation to follow him. So it's got to be rooted in relationship. You don't have to be the most formally theologically trained guy on the block. In fact, none of the 11 that were there on the rock outside of Galilee that received the Great Commission, none of them had any formal theological education. None of them were even a Levite. They were just men who had followed Christ. And in that invitation, he knew over the quantity of life spent together, there would be quality of life emerging, that he would get to imprint his worldview on them, his compassion for the lost on them, his desire to obey the Father on them, like the intimacy of in his prayer life, that they would see and feel and experience, and it would become theirs. Luke 6:40 is one of my favorite verses. It says, when the process is complete, the student will become like his teacher. And I've taken a lot of classes and a lot of undergraduate and graduate work, and I never became like the teacher just by learning in the classroom. But when you spend life with someone, why many of us are a lot like our dad or a lot like, you know, a family member or a close friend, we pick up those character traits. They become contagious. They get imprinted on you. When you experience life on life, you do have a sense of becoming like someone. And when you're discipling, the goal is that they become like Christ in you. That's what Paul would always say to the Thessalonians and the Corinthians. He would say, "Follow me as I follow Christ." And so we see in Jesus' model, he invited them. He spent, scholars say 85% of his 3-year public ministry, 85%, which is a gigantic amount, was spent with those 11, which means either Jesus was incredibly distracted from his mission of reaching the world, or part and parcel to that mission was spending gargantuan amounts of time with a few for the sake of the masses. And I think that absolutely was the case with Jesus and the genius of his strategy. And so he spends this time. He does life with them. Over the course of life, there's truth transferred. And that's how we define it at Downline. We say truth transferred in the context of relationship for the purpose of producing reproducers in Christ. That's just us trying to say what Jesus did clearly. Truth transferred in the context of relationship for the purpose of producing reproducers of Christ. And I love the verse in 1 Thessalonians 2:8. If you made me pick a verse that defines it, I would say 1 Thess 2:8, where Paul, speaking on behalf of himself and Silas and Timothy, he says to the Thessalonians, "We loved you so much that we gave you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well, because you became so dear to us." And so the bookends of discipleship, I believe, is a relationship that is with someone that you love and care about. It's the bookends are love, a loving relationship. And in the middle is giving them two things, the truth of the gospel and your life. And I think if that's your blueprint, I think you're doing exactly what Christ did with the 12. And so ultimately, I think you are making disciples. You're helping inspire and point other people to Christ by allowing them to follow you as you follow Christ. So, you know, a lot of guys tell me all the time, boy, I don't have any training. I can't possibly disciple. And, you know, it really gets down to some fundamental questions. Do you love Jesus? And are you pursuing him? And if so, discipleship's just inviting somebody to come with you. It's just taking a guy that, you know, I had another pastor I studied under named Tommy Nelson in Denton, Texas. And Tommy used to say, this is a little bit crass for the interview, but he used to say, all you got to do is find somebody dumber than you in the faith. And he says, surely you can find that. But it's true in the sense that, you know, even as a young believer, there are opportunities for me to minister to non-believers and other young believers and invite guys to just be on the journey with me as I was pursuing Christ. And so, you know, I think definition is important. I think we got to look at the blueprint of Christ. I think we've got to see it's this truth in life. And there's a purpose. There's a purpose of reproduction. I think maybe that's one of the differences in biblical disciple-making in mentoring or coaching. I think mentoring and coaching have a lot of this, hey, come experience with me, let me help you in a craft or in an area that I'm an expert, quote-unquote, in. But oftentimes there's not the onus of reproduction. And I think in biblical discipleship, Mark 3:14 says he called them out, designating them apostles that they may be with him and then go out to preach. And there was always the idea that, you know, Matthew 4:19, I will make you fishers of men. From the beginning, it was follow me and one day you'll do what I'm doing. And the Great Commission was just the handing off of that baton. It was the fulfillment of what was happening. But it's a very important part of the process. I don't think the process is complete until they are able to have their own relationship with Christ that they're growing in and invite others to follow them. So I'm speaking in some broad terms, but I do think that's how we have to kind of land on what exactly are we doing here.
You know, I was reading something the other day, and it really impressed on me that the disciples were probably in their teens. That was the normal age for a rabbi to start that process. And so, you know, this can happen at any time of life. And I think one of the other things I know you believe in, the whole idea of the downline of this, and why don't you just touch on that? Because I think, you know, so often busy doctors think, well, I don't have time for doing something like this with a whole bunch of people. But the point is to do it with one.
Absolutely. And the point is that it becomes a part of your lifestyle, no matter what the numbers are. The word downline, I literally heard Soup use it in passing one day. I heard him talking to someone else and saying, you know, four walls may never be around it. You may never see this with your eyes, but every believer, you know, scripturally, if we're really following Christ, we ought to have a spiritual downline that's ever increasing until Christ comes again. It just kind of stuck with me. I started thinking, is that true of my life? Have I invested my life in the gospel and others who are now investing in others, who are investing in others? Kind of that 2 Timothy 2:2, you know, invest to faithful men that which I've told you, and so that they may teach others also. And you just kind of see this expanding downline, and it stuck with me. It gave me a real vision for that. And I would say, listen, I know doctors are crazy busy. I know coaches and lawyers and homemakers who are crazy busy. And I would say that's one of the common denominators of 21st century American life, is that we're very busy. And Jesus seemed, I mean, he had a very full plate, if you think about the redemption of mankind. I mean, he was on a mission that was pretty taxing, and he was busy, but he was never in a hurry. And it was really just he was strategic in his busyness. He simply didn't go alone. And what I wish so badly, and there, you know, we all probably know those doctors who are really investing along the way. I've been really impacted by a couple doctors here in Memphis. One is Dr. David Libby, another one is Dr. Jim Reardon. These men are two of the greatest examples of the Great Commission seen as a lifestyle that I've ever seen. They've actually used their platform of medicine to connect with young dental and medical school students. And they've basically opened their home to these students coming to Memphis to study and learn, some Christians, some not Christians. But they've used hospitality in their home and a good meal to connect, to begin to share experience. And they've both led so many students to Christ and taken other young students and just continued to meet with them. In fact, one of those men, Dr. David Libby, by the request of some of the guys he led to Christ, they were saying, "We don't really know what the Bible teaches. Can you help us?" So he started a Bible study. It's now in its ninth year, and it's become a staple. And if you come to UT Memphis Dental School, everybody knows about it. He is probably has 30 guys in his study, that he teaches them the Bible the whole time they're in school. But the genius of his strategy is he gets time one-on-one with them, and here's how he does it. Just to give you one example, he's kind of come to the conclusion that even in our busyness, we all eat, and even in our busyness, we probably should try to do something to stay in shape. And so Dr. Libby eats meals and works out daily, but very rarely alone. Every time I see him out, he's always with a young man or a couple young men that are in his study. So he's teaching them the Word, but he's also just getting life with them. He's just talking to them, learning about their relationships, knowing how he can pray for them. They're getting to see how he loves his wife, Miss Donna. They're getting to see how committed he is to the Lord and giving his time to others and where he's serving in the city and how he's leading. So he is making this gigantic imprint on the lives of one student at a time, and then those dental students are going out to practices all over the country. And I promise you, I'm seeing it time and time again, they have as their DNA what he did with them. They almost can't help now but do that same thing and find some other young men, whether it be through their church, through their practice, in their neighborhood. They just start sharing their life and opening their house and teaching what Dr. Libby taught them, and it becomes their lifestyle, and it multiplies. And so I think if it's something we all weave into our lifestyle is, hey, this is just what it means to follow Christ, then I believe the Lord just can use that to spread his kingdom in multiplicative ways.
I think building it into your daily lifestyle is so key. This isn't an exceptional thing. This is a routine thing that is just as normal as getting up in the morning for a man and shaving or taking a shower or anything else. This is just part of the way I live every day that makes this happen. You know, one of the things, I saw one of your videos, you made the point of, you know, how many people would come to Christ if you preached and 1,000 people accepted Christ each day, or mm-hmm. and what you would do just one by one. Why don't you share that? Because I think it's a profound insight on the effect that this type of thing can have.
Yeah, and this is an illustration that Soup had shared with me one day, and boy, it turned some lights on. I never forgot it. He said, you know, if as an evangelist, you were, this is obviously a hypothetical situation, if you reached 1,000 people a day for Christ, and if we froze the population rate on earth and asked the question, how long would it take to reach the whole world for Christ? And the answer was over 15,000 years. And frankly, you can imagine the spiritual maturity or really lack thereof of all of these folks who have been reached, but then what? Many of them probably no idea how to grow, lack of growth. So 15,000 years and creating spiritual babies that have no idea how to mature. And that's, you know, there's nothing, I'm a huge believer in sharing the gospel, but just contrast that to the idea of if as a disciple maker, following in the footsteps of Christ, if you were to disciple, and that we're going to use just clear-cut numbers for easy math here, even though I don't think discipleship is ever quite this clean. If you were ever to disciple a young man for a year, and in the second year, you kind of challenge him to begin looking for someone to build into and pour into the way you're pouring into, and even with what you're pouring into him. So year two, he begins to disciple someone as you're still walking with him and supervising and shepherding, and at the same time, you find another young man to pour into. So year two, you're pouring into a new guy in the second year of the first guy who he is now pouring into someone. Well, year three, the guy he poured into finds someone, and you can see how the chain would grow. Well, I realize we have some spiritual forces of evil working against us when we get serious about the Great Commission, but for the sake of analogy and for the sake of making a very important point, if that chain were to continue unbroken, that chain of disciple-making, the question being posed, how long would it take to reach the world for Christ? And the answer now is in the 35th year, you'd literally, at a growing population rate, you don't even have to freeze it, 35th year, you'd reach the entire globe for Jesus Christ, and now look at the spiritual maturity of every believer who's been personally discipled and been in the process of making disciples in accordance with the model and mandate of Christ. And again, I don't think it's ever going to work like that because Satan, the world, and our flesh. But how strategic ought we to be? And I think the answer is just as strategic as Christ. If we care about seeing the redemption of mankind among the nations and the exalting of Christ among the nations, then I believe that that needs to be seen in the fact that we hurt for the masses. And so we see the masses through the man, and we build the man to reach the masses, that we are always building a few, knowing that God can take those investments and multiply that for great kingdom fruit.
You know, I think the other side of that, Ken, is this too. Somebody influenced us, or a number of people did, and brought us to our level of spiritual maturity. But if we broke the chain and we have not done our part to carry it on from there, that's been the problem over the last 2,000 years. We see the tremendous impact the 12 disciples had and the people they influenced, but if we've been part of breaking the chain. I think the other thing that when I talk to docs and students is, well, you know, I'm not a Bible scholar. I don't know where I would, you know, we're supposed to influence them with the truth and do some teaching like you mentioned happened with you every Tuesday morning, and I just don't know if I could do that. How do you tell people to start that process, and what resources do you all have available to know what are the things to focus on?
It's a great question, and I like you hear that constantly. Matter of fact, that's completely driven our ministry to create two resources because we've, for 8 years now, we hear that from everyone. And before I mention those, here's what I have had always said and still do say. And in its purest form, I think this can be a North Star in your life if that's you out there. I think the safest and best and most healthy thing to do, if that's where you are, is find a godly man, hopefully in your church. Pray that God would bring a quote-unquote Paul into your life and tell him that. Say, gosh, I really want to follow Christ. I really want to teach others. I want to disciple others. And I feel very ill-equipped. Can you begin to share some things with me? And then be committed to taking what you learn and passing those truths on. So Prof. Hendricks used to say the healthiest place for any Christ follower to be is having at least one Paul in his life. That's kind of a spiritual father, someone really feeding you and loving you and nurturing you and raising you in the faith. And at least a Timothy, someone that you are nurturing and you are feeding and you are growing and you're praying for and you're leading. And a bunch of Barnabases, a bunch of guys you're in there on the front lines with. And so maybe one of the healthiest things to do is find someone that you can follow and be committed to pass on what you're learning. You know, let me give you two things. We've worked 5 years on how can we help folks answer that question, that in tandem with finding a Paul in their life, or if they struggle to find that. And we have heard that at times as well. And so we've got two things. One is the Downline Institute, and it's local here in Memphis, but we have online communities all over the world. So everything we do here live is taped and available at a link, and you can go through it. And what we do is we don't assume anything. We have elder-quality men, lay leaders, pastors going through the program. Almost 200 a year here go through live. We've had over 1,000 people go through the program. And we literally open up Genesis 1:1, and we say, all right, let's see the meta-narrative of Scripture. Let's see what God's doing, and let's really get handles on the big picture of our Word of God. I was getting just tired of leaders in churches telling me they had no idea how to navigate their Bible. And it kind of was a heartbreaking thing. And so I said, we need to quit making assumptions. People know what they don't, and we need to quit shortcutting the process. Let's teach people the Word. And so in a 9-month program, we walk Genesis through Rev, and I can promise anyone listening that you will have an incredible understanding of the big picture of the Word of God, and you'll know how to navigate it in your own life as a student. It'll give you this beautiful foundation where everything now makes sense, and you can go and study and learn and grow. And so I would encourage anyone out there, no matter if you're in an English-speaking nation and have access to the Internet, you can go through the Downline Institute with us, and you can check that out at downlineinstitute.com for details on if you want to talk to one of us here at the office, and we can just walk you through what that looks like. You have to do it in community, which means two or more. So we want everyone to have someone they're doing it with, and Christ sent them out by twos, and that's great for accountability. So you and a friend, you and a spouse, you and some buddies in your church or your medical practice, but you go through it together, and I promise it'll revolutionize your knowledge of the Word, your understanding of what it means to follow Christ. The other tool, very practical, is the Downline Builder, and many of those listening may have heard of this. It's very unique. It's the first ever web-based customizable curriculum. that we've ever heard of. But if you're going, gosh, I don't know what to teach and how to teach it, this is an incredible tool. It's a $50 annual subscription, which means you'd pay $50, and for the next 12 months, all-you-can-eat buffet. If we have hundreds of lessons of curriculum online. And as a subscriber, you get to enter some data about the young man or young men, or young lady or young women you're pouring into. And it helps you to find the lessons in our library that would be uniquely relevant in the lives of those you're discipling. It's pretty self-explanatory when you're on it. It gives you all the suggested lessons based on what you're describing, and you build your own table of contents. And then when you go to Disciple, you have a teacher's guide and a student guide. So if you're going to teach them about the Holy Spirit or the church, and you go, gosh, I would know how to write a lesson or where to start, it's going to put a teacher's guide in your hand, and all you have to do is walk through it with them, and you'll be learning at the same time you're teaching. And the breadth of these studies, it's everything theologically and practically that we can think of. How to pray, how to share the gospel, soteriology, things of salvation. I mean, books of the Bible, apologetics. I mean, everything we can think of is in there, and it's growing. We probably add 15 to 20 lessons every month. And it'll be ever expanding. So a great tool that you could log on to today if you've got the potential disciple and you're just kind of stuck saying, I don't know what to teach and well, don't know my word well enough to just dig in there. And besides, these guys just need to know, topical things, how to date, how to pray, Well, this can give you a biblical perspective on almost anything, and it really puts it in your hands what you need. So those are a couple great resources. That's at downlinebuilder.com. So downlineinstitute.com and downlinebuilder.com could be two really helpful resources.
That's great, Ken. And I think the other issue with busy doctors is just time. It's not that they don't know how to learn, and sometimes not that they don't know their Bible, but I need to dig in to do this. Where am I going to find the time to do it? And having that help is essential. Kenan, I want to thank you for what you guys are doing. I don't know how many people know, if they're not involved with Global Health Outreach, how active you guys have been with our GHO teams going overseas and teaching discipleship in churches and groups we're working with. And I just want to say thank you for your faithfulness, for your boldness, for your courage, for your diligence in what you're doing. And it's been a joy to partner with you. And I pray that many members are going to get involved deeply into discipleship, because when it's all over with, that's what's really going to count.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I'd say the same thing. We have considered the partnership with GHO to be just a God thing. The way it happened was a God thing, and every trip, the fact that we can partner together with our different gifts and experience and meet the needs of people in so many different ways, to meet their physical needs, to have platform to share the gospel, and to train pastors, and just to love on people in all those ways, is a blast, is the great adventure of the Great Commission, and it's been just a lock and step fit for us, and so we're thankful to partner with GHO and just count that a great privilege.
God bless you.
You as well, David. I appreciate it.
Hey, check out that website that Kenan gave you and get involved. Just figure out one person that you want to start discipling. And it will bring the greatest satisfaction in your life to invest in that kind of depth in someone. Don't wait. Get started. I know you're too busy, but really you're too busy not to. And by the way, go on a GHO trip and work with Downline Ministries. Over 45 trips a year now. The best run medical dental mission trips in the world. And you'll have wonderful ministry. You'll touch people's lives. You'll help their health concerns. You'll share the gospel. But most importantly, your battery will be recharged, your heart will be renewed, and you'll be better prepared for the ministry that God's called you to, whether it's in this country or overseas. Hey, we've got some great marriage enrichment conference weekends coming up. If you haven't been to one of these, you've missed out. And it will make your marriage stronger. There's just no doubt about it. We get those testimonies all the time. One of them is especially for female physicians and their spouses, and it's going to be in beautiful Georgetown, Colorado, near Denver, April 11th through the 13th. If you are a female doctor, you don't want to miss this one. They'll be especially addressing the needs of your type of relationships. And then we got the national meeting coming up. And this year, it's in a new place we've never been before. Green Lake, Wisconsin. A beautiful area and a gorgeous resort. April 24th through the 27th. We've got a great lineup of speakers, wonderful workshops. Lots of students will be there. We're expecting many to come out from Chicago and that area. Why don't you come and join us? You haven't been? You've missed a wonderful time, and we'd love to renew our relationship with you if you've been before. It'll be great to see you as an old friend. Check it out at cmda.org and meet us at the 2014 National Convention, April 24th through the 27th in Green Lake, Wisconsin. I want you to get to know Dave Hafer, and I'm going to let him tell his own story as we get started. I think one of the things Dave demonstrates is you can retire and still make an enormous difference. It's not time just to hang it all up. You're going to enjoy getting to know him. He's a good friend. We've been in his home. He and Bobby, his wife, who they've been married for 37 years, are just wonderful people. What a testimony he has, too, of God's grace in their life. Let's hear what he has to say. David, it's great to have you on Christian Doctors Digest. I wanted to get you on just to tell the story of what God's been doing with you all in the last few years. Let's put that in context. Kind of give us a little bit of your background and practice and, you know, a kind of a short summary of your biography up to the last few years.
I was a musician that got started about age 5 playing the trumpet. And I knew that God had prepared my way to be a studio trumpet player. By the time I got to my junior year in college, it was obvious that I was running out of talent, even though I was practicing many hours a day. And I started taking science courses by my junior year and realized that this is where my real heart was positioned. I went and spoke to my father about the issue and said, I want to change majors. He told me in no certain terms that I owed him one favor, and that was that I finished one thing that I was doing, and after that was completed, then I could do anything else that I wanted to do. So I went away grumbling a little bit, thinking, gee, that's going to cost me another year of my life once I've made up my mind. But I ended up taking his advice, completed the degree, and then immediately started into the sciences with a pre-med degree. So I finished music, started in pre-med, completed the requirements there within a couple years, went to 4 years of dental school at Marquette University. I was offered a medical internship program after that, then ultimately offered a residency, 4-year residency in oral maxillofacial surgery after that. So I just continued on down the education pathway, ultimately finishing the degree. I was then offered the assistant chief of the program in Milwaukee at County General in Marquette. I stayed for 6 months and got involved in academia, absolutely loved it to the nth degree. But started having a burning desire in my heart to complete a lifetime of actual hands-on surgeon. Found out that in academia I was becoming an armchair surgeon. So immediately moved into private practice. That took me out to Montana and in a location where I could really fulfill everything that I'd been trained in, both trauma as well as orthognathic surgery. And I needed a fairly large draw for that. I moved to Great Falls, Montana, and spent 30 years practicing the full scope of oral maxillofacial surgery. So that's it in a nutshell. Ultimately retired.
How in the world did you get involved in fighting physician-assisted suicide in Montana? I mean, in retirement, with that background as a maxillofacial surgeon, actually became our point person, really, in leading the battle up there. How did that all come about?
Things were starting to brew in Montana in regard to compassion and choice coming in and wanting to ultimately legalize PAS in Montana. And I'm at the meeting at Mount Hermon, and several people are coming up to me when they find out I'm from Montana and said, what are you doing in Montana? You can't let this happen. I knew very little about what was going on, And I said, well, when I get back home, I'll investigate and try to figure out what this issue is all about. I was like everybody else, didn't have a clue. I got home, and a few days later, a phone call came from Seattle from Margaret Doerr, who was a lead attorney that's probably the most knowledgeable from a legal standpoint in regard to PAS, and she's been fighting this all around the country as a legal expert. And she somehow got my name, and that's still a little bit unclear. She doesn't even quite remember, but anyway, I received a phone call. It was probably God that directed her to me, but got a phone call, and she wanted to know if I would be involved in this. I said, Garsh, I don't know anything about it. I'll have to do some thinking about that, and I'll get back to you. I no longer got off the telephone with her. A day or two later, I get a call from Dr. Rick Blevins, pulmonologist, critical care doctor, head of intensive care at the hospital that I operated in for 30 years. So I knew him well, good friend, CMDA member. He called me up and he said, Dave, I just found out that you are the state rep for CMDA. And I said, yes, I am. And he said, we need to talk. And I said, regarding? And he said, PAS. This is making an appearance in Montana, and we have to fight it. So all of a sudden, I realized this is bigger than myself. What started down at Mount Hermon has immediately grown within a couple weeks from returning home, and I better be listening to what people are saying and anticipate that this is coming from the Lord. We talked about it, and we started to figure out how in the world we are going to deal with the problem. And the problem under the big tent is, how do you motivate people, and how do you get them educated and get them on board as an infantryman that wants to write letters, come to the state legislature, take the time out, and get involved. And I've since come to realize that is an extremely difficult thing to do. But that's how I got led into this subject. From that point forward, we put on a couple of educational meetings. We wanted to attract attorneys, physicians, and concerned public. And so we did that. Bobby and I set that first meeting up in Missoula. We had a fair crowd. I spent tons of time on the telephone making personal phone calls to try to get people involved in this. All of a sudden, I realized at this meeting, we had Margaret Doerr over, and then we had the previous senator who had introduced the bill against PAS in the previous legislature. He came and spoke. So it was really a good educational program, and we saw where the problem was, and we started thinking about how we actually need to get out in the forefront and fight the battle.
And that took you to the state house and legislature and more meetings. You know, and that battle continues, as maybe some of our listeners know, but many do not. Update them on what's going on right now, where it stands.
We right now are in standstill. It once again got tabled. We went much further this time in the state legislature than we did the first time. The first time it got tabled right off the bat in the Senate subcommittee. This time it got introduced as a House bill. We made it through that. We made it into the major House that got debated. We won the House debate. It then went to the Senate subcommittee. We ultimately tied 50-50 there, and we did a blast motion that blasted it out into the Senate floor, and the fight was on, and we lost by 4 votes in the Senate. We advanced much further this time around than we did the time before, which I wasn't involved at that point in time, but we went to Helena, we stood up, we debated the issue, we listened to the opponents and their side of the issues. It was a real educational experience for both my wife and myself. I talked to Bob Orr at the CMDA meeting in Ridgecrest, and he said, well, this will continue on for a long time. We've been fighting it for 10 years in Vermont, and it just gets more and more difficult all the time, and I think I understand the reasons for that. Anyway, that's where we're at right now, and we just had a conference call with all involved people, and once again want to start to develop some strategy, because we do have a physician in Missoula who has come out and written articles in the paper. He believes that it is legal in Montana, which it is not. He's utilizing a legal case, the Baxter case, as his support as a possible defense. But this has not passed the legislature and has not become law, and he has admitted to actually writing the prescriptions that has killed three patients. So we're trying to figure out how in the world are we going to deal with that issue and combat it, and in some ways almost tend to feel that this individual is trying to draw us into a lawsuit and have a major issue over it. And CNC, Comfort and Choice, has got big money that has come into the state to try and make this legal. So we're concerned about how this is ultimately going to play out, and that's pretty much where we're at right now.
In the midst of all this going on, and this was a real battle and continues, you had a personal challenge. Tell that story of what happened, because I think it's so often, you know, I'm too busy, I got too much going on, I can't stand up on these public policy issues, somebody else will do it for me. That type of thing, whereas, as you found, the key is local docs standing up and speaking out and the enormous influence they have in the battle. But you were standing up and speaking out, and then what happened?
When I was at the CMDA meeting last year in Ridgecrest, I was starting to have some physiological problems with bowel movements, and I got very concerned when I was there, and when I returned home from Ridgecrest, I called the gastroenterologist and got in and for an exam. And so immediately that afternoon, sent me over to the hospital and did an anal scope and took a look in the rectum. And sure enough, there was a tumor, about a 4-centimeter tumor growing, and biopsied at the time. And he was absolutely convinced that it was most likely an adenocarcinoma, and this is not a good picture, Dave. So we came home that afternoon, sat on the couch all afternoon, in fact all weekend, and cried, held hands, prayed, and just all of a sudden the world stopped in our little life. And we talked about a lot of things. When we finally stopped crying about it, we started to say, you know, let's trust God here in this whole ordeal. The good news from the biopsy report that I received Monday morning was not an adenocarcinoma, and he said he's totally shocked and surprised, but it turned out to be a squamous cell carcinoma. So that's good news. We got lined up with the oncologist, both medical oncologist and radiation oncologist, to proceed with the treatment plans. And the treatment for a squamous cell carcinoma has not changed for 30 years. It's exactly the same treatment. It involves chemotherapy and radiation therapy. And the chemotherapy is just starts and coincides with radiation therapy. But the chemo is just 4 days, two drugs, mitomycin C, which is just given on one day, and 4 days of 5-FU. This gets repeated again 4 weeks later, but in between, starting the first day, radiation therapy is the major treatment. The very difficult part of this treatment was the chemotherapy changed me from not even being able to recognize myself, as well as my wife not being able to recognize me psychologically. And the big thing that disappeared was desire. All I wanted to do was come home from the oncologist's office, crawl into bed and just lay there. I didn't want to read. I didn't want to hear TV. I didn't want to listen to music. I didn't want to do anything. And my comment about all of that was, if breathing hadn't been spontaneous, I wouldn't have taken a breath. That's actually what it did to me. And my poor wife, she didn't understand what was happening to me, and we're just following through the treatment program. The medical oncology was completed in 4 days. Still took some time to wear off. And the big problem there is what it does to your neutrophils. Went in Monday, started the chemo, and by Wednesday, my neutrophils had plummeted, and my medical oncologist said, "You're down to nothing. You know, in fact, I don't even want you to take your one neutrophil out for a walk on the street in case somebody sneezes." And that could be the end of me. So, boy, I'll tell you, this entire ordeal, this trial, was a real physiology lesson, and you really learn to appreciate every little aspect of your normal basic physiology and how great it is when everything is functioning well, and how you're on death door when it's not. And I always got a kick out of, in the doctor's offices anymore, you see the pain chart, 1 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's question to me is, how's the pain? How are you doing? Where's your pain level? And I'm just saying, well, you don't even have it registered on the chart. It should go much higher than what you have it just at a 10. I'm at a level of pain that's absolutely intolerable. When I got to the point to where I thought, okay, I cannot tolerate this any longer. I've reached that limit. I got up at midnight and had my Job talk with God, sat on the couch and said, okay, God, are all of these people that are saying they're praying for me, are they really praying for me? And then I said to God, even if they weren't praying for me, can't you do something about this? 15 minutes later, I went to bed with no answer from God. Got up in the morning, went into the radiation treatment center, and the 30-year tech came and said to me, Dr. Hafer, I just want to let you know that you've done the best of anybody that we've ever seen with this tumor, and you've done it without the pain pump, and furthermore, you only have 6 days left to go. And as my wife is driving me home after that, all of a sudden I realize there was my answer from God, that he used a human to point that out to me, how well I was actually doing in spite of my pity party and my inability to tolerate the pain on my level. That gave me enough strength to go home and say, honey, we only have 6 days. I can make it. And we made it through, and I graduated and got my diploma for the treatment. And I look back now, and I think that was a very, very pivotal moment for me, because I could have easily gone in and begged and said, please stop the treatment. I can't take it. Let's hold off. And I just didn't want to do that, because I knew what that would do for the statistics on the treatment.
Tell me what happened next, because people might think, well, that was the end of it and the pain got better. Actually, things got worse.
Yes, that was not the end of it. I figured as soon as they turned off the radiation, my body was going to start to heal fast. And so I just knew it was going to get better. Well, I ended up with a complication, not surprising. It started out with a anal lesion that was just minor to begin with, but rapidly grew into a 2 centimeter by 1 centimeter ulcer that ultimately eroded down into the skeletal muscle. And that became as severe as the last part of my treatment. But it wasn't getting better. And I kept going in to see my now follow-up doctor, who was a oncology surgeon. And he was aware of my ulcer because he had gone in to do the check immediately after treatment to biopsy any area to see if there was any evidence of the tumor. And the news came back that there was no evidence of tumor. He couldn't even see where it had been, and biopsied many areas. Biopsies absolutely negative. So We went back in 3 months later, took another look. It was as big as ever, and no evidence of any healing taking place. And I'm loading up on oxycodone, which I just did not want to do, just trying to survive the pain situation. So this went on for 6 months, and nothing is improving. And I'm sitting around at Christmas time thinking, who in the world can I just call out of the clear blue sky and talk to about my problem? And Richard Johnson came to my mind.
The president of the CMDA.
President. Yeah. And I had met him at the last time that I was at the CMDA meeting, and I knew that he was senior surgical staff at Dartmouth. So I thought, gee whiz, I wonder if I could get this guy on the phone just to simply have a conversation and see what his thoughts would be, and maybe he would have a colorectal surgeon just down the hall. I called Richard Johnson, and poor Richard, he's wondering, I'm just the new president, do I have an irate state rep on the phone that's just going to take my ear off? So I explained the situation in detail to him and said, you know, I just thought maybe you would have a colorectal surgeon you could just run this by. So he said, well, Dave, my friend down the hall is out of town, but I have another personal friend who's a colorectal surgeon that I trained with in general surgery, and a real good friend of mine. Let me see if I can reach him, and I'll call you right back. But the real blessing, once again, came from God. Richard Johnson finishes by saying, Dave, can I just say a prayer for you? And this took me totally off guard, and I said, oh my, would that be a blessing? And Richard Johnson just prayed the most wonderful, merciful prayer. And as he was praying, the pain was dissipating. Before my very eyes, I could not believe it. And I said, gee, Richard, thank you so much for your prayer. I just want to let you know, something has just happened. My pain has just gone away, and it has never come back. I'm 6 months down the road from that point, and I've never taken a pain pill since that day. Wow. I went in to see my oncologist surgeon. He said, let's go back in and take a look, and the ulcer had totally healed. No evidence of the ulcer. So there you go. I told this to Bob Orr, and he jumped for joy and said, there's a miracle. That fits all my definition of a miracle. And what a joy it was to see that God still is in the business of mercy healing. We know that it's just when it happens to you and you see it. It's the greatest faith builder that I could have ever had.
David, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to share with us. What a story of a faithful walk with the Lord. And may the Lord bless you as you continue to follow Him. And we'll be praying and supporting you as you lead this battle in Montana on physician-assisted suicide.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Well, that a great story. It just warms your heart to see what God has done. And David's faithfulness and he and Bobby working together is just an inspiration to me. Hey, if you want to get more information on physician-assisted suicide and how you can make a difference, we've got a great Just Add Water DVD. Bob Orr speaking, Is Physician-Assisted Suicide Ever Justified? And then also a presentation on decision-making and clinical ethics. Great thing to use with your CMDA group, or to get a group of healthcare professionals, show at your office, or just get a good review for yourself. Another great resource is Why the Church Needs Bioethics by John Kilner, who works at Trinity University and used to head up the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. This is a book that's needed to be written for a long time because so many churches have disengaged, or they just don't understand the issues. They're so complex. What a great gift to give a pastor or a church leader. What a great thing to put in the church library. It's available here at CMDA. You can just go to cmda.org or give us a call at our toll-free number, 888-230-2637. You know, one of the things I'm really excited about in this new year is that we're just putting the finishing touches on our new evangelism curriculum. You remember the old saline solution? We did it about 10 years ago, and unfortunately it's got a little outdated, and new techniques, new ways to do things have happened. The new thing is called Grace Prescriptions. I love that title because it's really what we want to be all about. So whether you went to saline solution or not, you need to get charged up. If you've been before, this will be a great review of some basic principles, a lot of new things, a good opportunity to bring your pastor, another colleague, a medical student, a resident to a conference. It will be held across the country and hopefully one close to you in your area. If you have been to Saline Solution, you need your batteries recharged, just like I do. You get busy, you forget things you should be doing, and the inspiration and retraining and review will be more important to you than your continuing medical or dental education, because it will help you be God's vehicle to transform lives. So make it a priority and come join us. And then, almost as you're going to get the CDD, we're going to be filming this as a small group video series that will enable you to use this with your staff, use it with a local CMDA group, just invite in other physicians, nurses, and others to do something and sponsor it at your local church, whatever. So stay tuned for that. It's going to be a wonderful resource to spread this, not only in this country, but literally around the world. Well, till we get a chance to get together again, may God bless you. We're here to serve you. We exist because of you. And working together, we can always do more than we could do separately. We, as transformed doctors, working together, can transform the world as we motivate, train, and equip each other to glorify God. May God bless you.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations.